Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with My Science Hour. This is for June 9th, 2022, in the ongoing year-long series of History of My Discoveries. And tonight, a really important epic piece of work that came out of the early 1980s. And once again, the reason I was on the cutting edge of this entire field was because I had already worked out the electromagnetic conditions in the solar system. And as I've said before, if you didn't know those, you would never in your wildest imagination design an electromagnetic propulsion system that worked on the principle of electric fields and electric currents and resulting magnetic fields and how these combine to allow you to design an electromagnetic propulsion system. I've talked about being in the historical part of presenting this in venture capital groups in Los Angeles. I've already talked about that. Tonight I'm going to concentrate on the significance of the science part of this. And this also, I was an invited speaker at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference. It was held in Colorado Springs. And then we had some field trips also out to, we had some field trips that went out to some of the secure regions. There's a lot of military work around Colorado Springs in the terms of rocket building, etc. It was interesting the day that we went as part of the field trip for this electric propulsion conference, and it was all military. And but anyway, they had a single piece of aluminum rocket casing that filled a warehouse. It was probably 150 feet long, and they had automated machining, and they were machining out the aluminum. And I've seen this before, where they were the old original before composites. They would take a single block of aluminum and machine it down to sometimes almost paper thin, and carve out certain areas to allow strength, because if you look at physical structures, they don't have to be a continuous piece of metal. You can put holes in them or grind down certain regions without compromising strength. And, of course, reducing weight is the name of the game whenever you're dealing with aerospace, rockets, etc. And so we toured the plant. Also, they have a tower which is used. It's a big, tall tower, and they could shoot projectiles down this tower, and also they could do gravitational experiments, etc., in this very tall tower, which it was just interesting. That later came into play when, in the probably the 2000s, I was called by an engineer who was a Tier 1 engineer in the aerospace industry. And actually, he was talking about prime numbers because he was in charge of encryption on military satellites, and he wanted to know the significance of breaking the RSA codes. And this is after my Calculate Primes book came out in 2007. And then we got talking. It was very interesting. We got talking back and forth about weather work and things like that. And so I started talking about my experience of presenting at these meetings, because he was working at the same company and happened to be working in that tower that I just was talking about. So we were talking back and forth, and so I told him about the electromagnetic propulsion system and some of the other work that I had designed, and he said, wait a minute. He said, you are talking to me about the projects that I have worked on. I have worked on these projects, and you're telling me about the projects. There's no way you could know about this. And I was talking at a level of design of the project. I designed the projects. And, of course, I was segued away from these because I did not want to use the designs, my inventions, for delivering nuclear bombs. I've talked about that. And so anyway, this engineer who called me up about prime numbers and breaking the encryption codes and how they could potentially fix these in telecommunication satellites for the military we got to talking, and when I was relating the places I had been to in Colorado Springs and the Gravity Tower, which he had been working on at the time. And like I say, he said, there's no way you could know about the projects that I worked on at the level you're talking. And I told him, I designed these projects. And he was just, his mouth was hanging open because he knew that I was, you know, that I knew about these projects. But at any rate, tonight I'm going to talk about the discoveries that went into these propulsion systems. For example, I'll just give you, bait the hook a little bit here and give you an idea. The magnetic propulsion systems, now this is the active one, the one that you can see in the Atlantis to Tesla book, the reprint. And by the way, that reprint is from the IEEE journal that covered that conference. That is now published online as an archive with my name. So you can look up magnetic propulsion system or MPS, J.M. McCanney, and that will pop up, and you'll see the same article that I have published in the Atlantis to Tesla book, once again confirming. Or you can look up 19th International Propulsion, it's 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, put in my name McCanney, and that article will pop up as an archived article and dealing with the propulsion system. But for example, the battery, now this propulsion system uses quartz tubes, and which are insulators. So once you run a current through these, that current cannot get out of the tube, and then they're permeable to magnetic fields. And so what it gives you is a electromagnetic propulsion system using electric currents, basically a ball lightning battery, and these are plasma batteries, so the plasma currents, there are no physical connections, although I talk about those in the article. When you get to actually the design, there are no physical terminals, like electrical terminals, etc. So these are glass tube connectors. And this is why I also have said that you do not need modern computers, etc., or electronics to build spacefaring propulsion systems. Anyway, very important. But the design of the electric battery came from my understanding of fusion in the atmosphere of the sun. And so anyway, very important how you create the cell, how you tap into the cell's electric field, is from my work on understanding the fusion is in the layer, in the surface atmosphere, and up, well, in the atmosphere of Jupiter, Saturn, and of course the sun. So once again, nobody would have known about this because everybody in standard physics, including Tier 1 physics, believed without reason, without really understanding the difficulties in it. And that's when, like when I was talking with Hans Bethe at Cornell, he knew about the difficulties of the core fusion model because he was one of the people that created it. And there were serious problems. And so I went to him talking about atmospheric fusion in the sun, and he knew I had hit the nail on the head, and that's when he recommended that I start publishing my journal, my articles in the European journals. I've talked about that, where I've started to publish the papers were being sent directly to publication by the head editor. And one of the things that Hans Bethe was convinced of my work, because it solved the issues they were having with the core fusion model. It didn't add up, and he knew it. They knew that there were serious problems. And so anyway, getting back to the propulsion system, but the issue was that the battery for this was a plasma battery. For this propulsion system came from my understanding of how the atmospheric fusion worked in the sun, and of course related to Jupiter and Saturn because they are small stars also. Okay, so this is what I, that's just a piece of what I'm going to talk about tonight. The other thing is understanding the electric fields and the magnetic fields and where they formed and how they were used. For example, when you have a magnetic propulsion system, what you're doing is you're creating a magnetic field that pushes against, for example, say, Earth's magnetic field. Well, Earth's magnetic field is very weak. It's there, but it's very weak. It's not like, for example, the magnetic field around Jupiter, which is pretty strong. By cosmic terms, when you're near Jupiter, etc., the magnetic field is pretty strong. But in terms of what you need for a propulsion system, it's still not that strong. If you create, here's a good example of a magnetic apparatus that is used. It's called a railgun, and it's basically a magnetic field that's generated between two rails, and you drop literally a metal bar across it, and the current between the rails, you have voltage across the rails, and so you have current going through this piece of metal, and it works against the magnetic field and accelerates the bar down the track. So that's a magnetic propulsion. There are also electric propulsion systems, and I'll talk about these a little bit, that they are ion engines, but there's another type of just electric field, and they are used now actually in jet engines. There's a type of jet engine that uses an electric field and acceleration where you ionize the gas coming in. You have stages, just like in the old tandem van de Graaff accelerator. If there are physicists out there that remember the old post-World War II, they were called atom smashers. They had one, I believe it's still there at the University of Minnesota, and I worked on that with the professor there that ran that. I doubt if he's still there, to do an experiment dealing with the redshift of light. But anyway, that's another topic. But also at the Electric Propulsion Conference, one of the main contributing apparatus that was being presented there was the ion engine. And for example, you can take an ionized material, or what you do is you vaporize it so it's in plasma form, ionize it typically with a UV light or some other mechanism for ionizing the material, so that draws the electrons off. Then you expose this to a screen where the ions are accelerated, and they go out the one end, and the electrons go out the other end, and because of the about 2,000 times difference, the protons, the electrons form the majority charge carrier. However, the protons carry the energy. It's an interesting situation. So they accelerate the ionized, the positively ionized plasma out in the other direction, and that causes a force. And once again, we get back to this idea of specific impulse. The force generated by an ion engine is extremely small, but you can do it over days and days and days and days out in outer space. And so they'll operate for a long period of time. So the end result is that over a long period of time, you can get the same energy result, in other words, or momentum change result, however you want to look at it, in the payload as you would with a big chemical rocket. And because the particles go out with much higher energy, you don't have to carry as much fuel. And so that gives it a much better specific impulse rating in terms of engines. So they're being used, ion engines are being used in spacecraft now. They have been for a long time. But this is where they got their birth. And I remember standing there looking at these on the table, and people had actually built hardware, tubes and thrusters, etc., based on the principle of the ion engine. But I was the only one there with a magnetic plasma propulsion system. And so once again, nobody understood what I was doing to begin with. Once I explained it, they understood. These were very good physicists, and I had already been vetted by the physicists in Los Angeles Remember, the International Propulsion Conference was 1987 when this was published. And so I believe it was 1986 was the actual conference. But the magnetic propulsion system, I had already proposed, and it had already been worked into the aerospace industry back in literally 1982 when I was in Los Angeles after I came back from Canada. And I went out to Los Angeles. I got my nice job in the telecommunications industry. But an invited talk in 1986 to the Electric Propulsion Conference was just part of my growth pattern. I also gave a similar talk at the Aerospace America. Basically, it was an air show held in San Diego. It was supposed to be the United States answer to the Paris Air Show, but it kind of flopped. It only did 1 year, and it never came back. But interestingly enough, I went there talking about my propulsion system, and I met Bert Rutan. Bert Rutan was there with scaled composites, his early days. He had already been building the long easies and the experimental aircraft with composites, using foam covered with composites and making lightweight aircraft, usually a push engine, and with the canard style of aircraft design. But he was there. And, you know, Bert, long sideburns and cowboy boots, he had his own style, and he didn't care about anybody else. But he was building composites, and oddly enough, that's what I needed to build the structure for the electromagnetic propulsion system, because I needed a material that did not expand or contract with temperature or in the vacuum of outer space. It was very stable, but it was non-conductive and did not interfere with the magnetic field. And carbon fiber was the perfect material. So I needed that material to build the structures. And if you look in the Atlantis to Tesla book, there's the design of what some people might call a flying saucer. And so at any rate, that's a very crude example of a flying saucer. But it shows the work that I put together for the patents, which then when you get to that level, they don't issue patents. They take that off of, you know, because it's something, a patent is going to be observed by everybody. But the drawings that I had were for the magnetic propulsion system for in atmosphere, for out of atmosphere, and then also a docking device. So the docking device was very interesting because you would have the magnetic propulsion system basically setting up magnetic fields in two rings with the quartz tubes, and it would be used to bring spacecraft together very slowly and very deliberately in a docking maneuver in outer space. So these were some of the applications of my plasma magnetic propulsion system. So it was called Controlled Plasma Magnetic Propulsion System, CPMPS. Controlled Plasma Magnetic Propulsion System was the official name of the active plasma propulsion system that I designed. Okay, so now jumping ahead, finally it was in the mid-2000s when I was publishing my books that were for the public. I had my radio show. I was taking this public. I was on a lot of national, international radio shows, etc. And so my book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, came out. And I talk in there about the LEBs, the local electrical batteries. So these were what I discovered. And I knew about these back in the days of the mid-1980s, of course, because it certainly wouldn't help you to have a magnetic propulsion system if you did not have the electric and magnetic fields that were integral in working with these. And so just to give you another example, when my Atlantis to Tesla book came out, it was like 2002, 2003 timeframe, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, I talked about Atlantis. So I talked about Tesla, the vertical electric field, and how Atlanteans also were using the same principle. of tapping into the vertical electric field using, they used the same concept of a Schmitt trigger, breaking the, and that's used in a Tesla tower or in a Tesla, basically a Tesla ring or Tesla transformer in the laboratory, and you get a very high frequency resonance in this device. And what you can do is with that drill up through the vertically in the atmosphere, changing rapidly the dielectric, the induced dipoles in the atmospheric molecules, and you drill up and then create a current to come down to complete the circuit, which cannot happen because the air is a dielectric. It's a capacitor. And so anyway, here's the issue. It's like, say, a runway for a jet engine aircraft or a propeller aircraft to take off. You have to go down a runway to get up enough speed so you can take off. Well, it's the same thing is true with an electromagnetic propulsion system. The only thing is, the Earth's magnetic field is not strong enough to support. You'd have to have extremely high currents, like million amp currents, and I talk about that in the paper, to push against Earth's magnetic field, which is very low. So what you do is you create an artificial electrical discharge using the Tesla tower, and of course this is what they were doing in Atlantis. They had seawater batteries. They had big, like cement basins that would fill and then stay filled with the tide, and then using bimetallic strips to create the voltage, and that was used to then with Schmitt triggers to power the Tesla tower. And then once the electrical current was tapped into the vertical electric field, they no longer needed the batteries, just like Tesla was reproducing this same thing at Wardenclyffe and in Colorado Springs. Interestingly enough, I was doing I was explaining where Tesla got his energy from as part of my presentation at the Electromagnetic Propulsion System Conference, because you needed that current and the resulting magnetic field. Now, can you imagine, just sit back and close your eyes and think for a minute of Atlantis. Here you have the five-ringed city that was designed for protection. So you had the people, the commoners, living around the outside ring, the workers. And then as you went into the inner rings, you had the hierarchy. And in the very center was the center mound of Atlantis. Atlantis was a city, Atlantis was a continent, and Atlantis was a worldwide empire. So you have places like at the South Pole or Egypt that were stations, which were, what would you call them, like outposts of the main hub of Atlantis, but the main city of Atlantis. Now the ships would come in from the ocean, they come through the Sunda Strait between Java and Sumatra, where the twin volcanoes were Krakatoa and its sister volcano, which at the time were complete volcanoes, and the columns of smoke coming up from those lit the sky for hundreds of miles around. So the mariners just had to come in, and the Phoenician mariners were, remember that this was before the pole shift, before the Venus pole shift. So the passageway was around what we now call Antarctica. The Phoenician map showed the coastline, and that's what Columbus had, the Peri Reis map, showing the coastline of South America that were used by the Phoenician traders as they went around the ocean. And at that time, the ocean was just one ocean. They called it the Ocean of the Atlanteans. So that's where the term Atlantic Ocean. The Pacific Ocean was not named until Magellan came into the Pacific Ocean, and it was so calm the day he entered that that he called it Pacific, pacified, calm. And so, but anyway, the Atlantean, back to Atlantis. So you can imagine coming in the center of the inner ring of Atlantis is this massive golden statue of Poseidon, which was the Tesla Tower. in the form of Poseidon with his golden rod and pitchfork standing up and connecting to the vertical electric field and the discharge, and this powered the city. And of course, they had laser beams. They had already discovered lasers. And if enemy ships came in, it was surrounded, by the way, by bogs of very tall grass, and there were only cut channels where the mariners could come in. And occasionally, somebody that really didn't know what they were doing would try and come in with ships and attack Atlantis. And they would use lasers to burn them out of the water, because these were wooden ships with cloth sails back in the day. Okay, so anyway, back to what this looked like. Close your eyes. You see the ringed city. You see the activity. It's lit up like a Christmas tree because of the atmospheric electricity is being fed out underground into the ringed city, and had light bulbs, of course, so it literally lit up like a Christmas tree. And in the center, the electrical current coming down, which was mildly illuminating the night sky, and then the spacecraft coming up and down and riding the magnetic field up and down like a giant international airport today, but with the flights coming in and out vertically. This is during a time also when Mars, according to the legends, this is not my recounting, but this is what I have read and understand, is that Mars was active, had a human population, and also had this type of activity. So the little rovers that you see in the little drone that's flying around Mars is all hokey-pokey science. That's what they pawn off to the public. The real science going on at Mars is discovering the ruins that are there left over from the Baal-operated civilizations that were there. Baal came from Mars. That is the, and they landed in the part of Europe that was Transylvania at one point in time, and they are the precursors to the banking system, the Rothschild ancestors, etc., who settled in the Black Forest, who became the World Banking Empire. So their history goes way back. And of course, none of you know anything about this because it's completely kept secret. And the secret societies, etc., that have gone through the ages. But just imagine this picture of Atlantis, and then all of a sudden, one day, there was a slewing event, and Atlantis slewed off into the ocean and never to be seen again until the U.S. submarines were able to go in and investigate and do archaeological recovery, which, of course, all of this, and at the Antarctica also, where they found, of course, mastodons and entire populations with cities, and all of this information is being kept from the public also. But anyway, that's part of Atlantis. But the point is that what I did in discovering the work of Tesla and expanding it to understand the vertical electric field and where that electric field comes from, and the way the way of discharging and reproducing that, that was what was contained in the Atlantis Tesla, the Colvin Connection book. So now back to the physical structure of the propulsion systems. So now I've talked about the way of getting the enhanced magnetic fields. You need a very strong magnetic field for these systems to work. I've talked about the following before. When you're dealing with interplanetary flight, the magnetic fields are really, really, really small. But there's a characteristic thing that happens with comets, primarily comets, or with planets also. Earth does it, Jupiter does it, all of the planets do this. They discharge the solar capacitor, and in doing so, create an electric current. And that current is primarily, the carriers are primarily electrons, because their charge to mass ratio is very high compared to, say, protons or ions or dust particles that are charged, etc. So the primary charge carriers are electrons, and their current creates a magnetic field. And so that's why astronomers and space scientists and astrophysicists incorrectly call the Earth's magnetic tail a magnetic tail. It's not a magnetic tail. In a sense, you might say that, but magnetic fields don't simply just exist. They don't exist. They would be neutralized in outer space in a New York second if there were not some kind of ongoing mechanism to keep the currents going, which keep the magnetic fields going. I've talked about this with the magnetic fields of Earth, the permanent magnetic fields of Earth, of locked in the iron and the nickel in the Earth's mantle and surface. And these cooled as the Earth cooled through the Curie temperature, and this took a very long time, potentially hundreds of thousands of years. And so as this cooling process occurred, there had to be an external magnetic field working on those magnetic materials, iron, nickel, etc., to maintain an external magnetic field while those magnetic materials cooled, locking the magnetic field in them. Okay, so once again, you have to understand how the enhanced magnetic fields are formed and how to discharge these, and in the case of a comet, the comet is the biggest discharge in the solar system, so it creates the biggest resulting magnetic field. And so that is why if you are going to leave the solar system, or if you are coming into the solar system, an alien, or someday when we get to other solar systems, you come in at high speed and you have to hook into that electrical discharge of the comet. And what you're doing is you're braking, you're basically like aerobraking or any other kind of braking, you're using that magnetic field to push against to slow you down. And that is why big comets like Hale-Bopp potentially could be associated with aliens. I'm not saying that Hale-Bopp was, but I can tell you something. There were, according to my inside information, there were alien signaling coming from the region of Hale-Bopp when it first was excited into a large comet. Not before then, not when Harrington had discovered the Planet X object that became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. It was after the comet discharged, and there was signaling that came from the comet. Now, it could be something natural, but according to the sources, it was something intelligent. So they were signaling that they were on their way in, basically, to visit Earth, etc., and pay a visitation. And that's why the CIA was freaking out. The CIA freaked out. Okay, I'm not going to go into all of that. That's another story. I don't want to contaminate this particular conference, this particular lecture tonight with that really very sick story about what happened there. Okay, so anyway, back to the science of the electromagnetic propulsion system. So I'm getting up on a stage and talking about this to a population of Tier 1 physicists. At the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, I would estimate there were probably 300 people there, and primarily men. In those days, you did not see many women at these conferences, and like it or not, I'm just reporting a historical fact. And the companies that were represented there also, the same thing. I think the company that we went out and visited on the field trip was Martin Marietta, and they had their rocket works there where they were building, I believe they were ICBMs, and we were looking at the rocket casings of the ICBMs that were out there, etc., and the vertical tower. They used that vertical tower for very high-velocity projectiles. And I think the reason they liked it vertical was because if you do it horizontal, you always have that gravitational effect where it's going to pull down. And so it's not perfectly coming into the target. Whereas if you have a vertical tower and accelerate a very high velocity projectile, it'll come perfectly straight down into the target. And I think that was the issue. That was why they built that vertical tower. for high velocity impact experiments. Okay, so let's look at the spacecraft itself. It's gyro-stabilized, meaning you have spinning wheels that stabilize it inside. They spin inside, and then outside you have like basically a flying saucer type of craft, and then out from the edges of that you have insulators that are holding a quartz tube, and a quartz tube in the form of semicircles. Now, one of the theoretical issues here is that you have current, that is electrical current, and you have two quartz tubes that are in semicircles, and the current is moving relative to the magnetic field. It's moving in the same direction. So the question is, how do you complete the circuit with the battery? Because you have contained plasma in the tubes, but you need a return current sheet that is not contained, because if you had it contained, then it would push in the opposite direction and there would be no dead effect. So the return current has to... I'm going to stop here. I'm not going to explain more about this because this is part of the somewhat the secret of the device, is how does this thing work and how do you how do you manage the return current sheet? I'll just put it that way. And by the way, it's very interesting. I told you about the company in La Jolla, California. There's a few sessions ago when I was talking about presenting this to the people in Los Angeles, and this was stolen by a group of charlatan company working in La Jolla who had the tether project for the space shuttle. They were going to let a tether out of the space shuttle, and of course I told them not to do that. They did it anyway, and they had a major electrical discharge just like I said they would. But my point is, when I was talking with this guy who was a physicist working in his company in La Jolla, is stealing my project basically because they could get his boss could get money from NASA to fund this, and then they changed the tether project from trying to create an electric current and a battery into a propulsion system using the tether, and of course it didn't work because they just about blew up the shuttle doing this. Really stupid. But anyway, he asked me the same question because he didn't understand it, and it was something I did not give to the military when I gave my talk. I always held something back. And so that was one of the secrets of the design. How did you get the return current sheet without creating an equal and opposing force with the contained plasma tubes? That's part of the design. How does that work? The spacecraft is a composite material, and it's gyro stabilized, so that gives it a very stable platform, in exactly like a flying saucer. The forces are controlled by the direction of current in the contained plasma tubes, so that allows the spacecraft to go up or down or sideways or front or back or sideways as you turn it, and then encounter the magnetic field of Earth. And so I talk about the forces necessary. So there's an atmospheric model, which has the battery inside is what is used to produce the current. And that is a fusion-based, it's using the same fusion process as used in the sun. It's called on a small scale, some might call it ball lightning, or some may call it controlled plasma fusion, and it's a low energy fusion. Sometimes think of fusion, you think of a fusion bomb or a runaway explosion, and it can be used in that way also. That has been done. But the sun is a very controlled reaction. If the sun were to one day explode, it would burn up all the hydrogen in a matter of seconds. But it doesn't. It's a very controlled process. Something like maybe, say, a forest fire, where it burns and it burns and it burns, but it doesn't burn up all at once. And so that's a very crude example, but that's the best example I can think of as far as a controlled fire, so to speak, or it's actually an electrical fire. And in the sun, I talk about this in my books, that you can, the public release books that you can read, is that the fusion is kicked off and controlled by lightning bolts. It's the pinch effect when the lightning bolts bend, and it's in those sharp bends where the very high pressures occur that kick off the fusion reaction. And once the fusion reaction kicks off, it creates more fusion in the region, and then it expands out and it cools down. And this is why, for example, solar storms create the proton wind that leaves the sun. I've talked about this. The solar corona is a sea of electrons. It acts as a screen. It accelerates the positively charged protons out, and then they migrate out in the solar wind, which continues out beyond the orbit of Pluto and holds back the nebular ion cloud, etc. So this is the core issue and design of the magnetic propulsion system. And so just once again, you would not even think about designing it unless you understood, like I did, the location and strength of the magnetic fields, how you could enhance those, as in the case of Atlantis, or how you could enhance those in the case of comets. Okay, I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk about some of the other venues, because when you are talking in front of this large group of people, specialists, then you inherently, because it's something very unusual and unique, you get invited to other venues, you to speak, etc. And so I found myself being invited to places where there were groups and audiences. And I particularly remember one, and everybody was well-dressed in suits, etc. And so I had to be well-dressed at some of these. Some of them were more casual. But I was giving my presentation in front of a group of people, and I ended it by stating that I had done all this by myself. I didn't have government contracts, etc. And these were all corporations, people from corporations who lived on government contracts. And I got almost a standing ovation, a huge round of applause, because people were sitting there looking at me like, you know, you're the man from Mars, because everybody there, their livelihood, their corporations, everything they did depended on getting government funding. So it just kind of a unique perspective as I moved through these groups and through these episodes of my life, that that's a recurring theme. And as, for example, I would go to American Geophysical Union meetings, which mainly was dealing with my electrical nature of the solar system, the plasma effects around the sun, solar physics, solar magnetophysics, and things like that. But at the AGU meetings, I would have my badge. You have this big square badge, and you wear it on your lapel or something, and pins on, and it gives your affiliation. And I always had independent scientist or independent researcher, whatever. And people would look at that, because when you'd come up to meet somebody or talk to somebody, or they'd come up to your, or say, a poster event or to talk to you, they would shake your hands, and inevitably they would look at your face for a second, but then they'd look at your name and affiliation. So you didn't have to say your name, etc. Somebody might ask you how you pronounce your name, but they would look at your name and affiliation, and so that you didn't have to state that. And inevitably they would say, well, independent scientist, what is that? And I tell them that I don't have government funding, I'm independent, I do all my own research, etc. And it was like this deer in the headlights look that you would always get. How is that? How could you possibly do things without government support. Okay, so anyway, I want to switch gears and talk a little bit just about the meeting itself and what it's like to be in one of these, you know, as a high-level military meeting, and purely physicist. And so remember that I had an appointment to the Naval Academy when I was a freshman in college, and I turned it down. I didn't go. These are all the people who would have been my classmates, because they went to the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy. These are all academy-level people with PhDs in physics who were career military scientists. They didn't go get a PhD and then work for a corporation and then get plucked up into Tier 1 science. They went right from the beginning, and so that's what I would have been doing if I would have continued on. And I probably would have never flown the jet planes that I thought I was going to fly. I would have simply gone further into physics and et cetera, and literally would have been owned stock, lock, stock, and barrel by the military. But there's a good possibility also that I would have never discovered all of the things that I discovered, because it took a very special route in life to do all of these things, to be in the right place at the right time. I would have probably been consumed on projects that were invented by other people and spent all of my time doing things, menial tasks or tasks, not sometimes not so menial. And maybe I would have worked my way up very high in the ranks, but I probably would never have made even 1% of the discoveries I did make. Very interesting turn of events. So these people at these meetings were career military physicists, primarily chemists, some chemists, but primarily physicists, and very good, very knowledgeable. And I think I mentioned once before, there's always a jerk in these. And so I was up giving my actual talk at the International Electric Propulsion Conference. And this guy was a younger guy, probably my age at the time, and maybe a little older, because I was then in maybe around 35 years old. And he would interrupt me with some commentary. And finally, a guy that was basically my sponsor there, the person who invited me and et cetera, got up on the stage and took this guy to task verbally in my behalf, because I was just being nice to him. If it were today, that guy wouldn't have lasted 10 seconds in my audience. I would have ripped him a new behind pronto. But in those days, I was a little bit more genteel, naive, and probably a little more courteous than I am today. So after being a little bit rad-hardened, you might say radiation-hardened, against the kind of idiots that might come up at a meeting, etc. But be that as it may, the majority of people there are very nice, very courteous, very respectful, and very good at understanding science. But the idea that these people were still locked into the idea that core fusion of the sun, they had no idea what caused the solar wind or why there would be an excess current of protons and therefore electrical discharges, which would cause electron currents, which would cause augmented magnetic fields, which could be used for transportation. Not even in the ballpark for understanding or conceiving of things like this. So at any rate, and then as I said, I went on to develop the passive magnetic propulsion system, which I have not released, and also the system for dealing with the Van Allen radiation belts and radiation in space in general, the solution. And it's very simple. It's like everything in nature, but it's not something I divulge publicly. It's not something I would give to the military. It's not something I would give to anybody. And at some point in my life, I'll divulge that on how that works. I'm not even going to say more about that. I'm going to talk now about the Airspace America air show in San Diego. I talked about meeting Bert Rutan there, but they had a B-17 bomber there, part of the air show. They had a lot of private aircraft. And then they had the B-2 bomber, which was there. It was the first exhibition of the Delta Wing version of the B-2 bomber. And I remember it took off, and it did a afterburner. It took off, and they kicked in the afterburner, so there was like the big afterburner explosion type of thing. And so that everybody was there was a timed event when that was going to happen, so it didn't scare everybody, and thinking that something had exploded. But other than that, it was mainly a lot of private talks, and I happened to be one of those. It was an invited talk once again, and I talked about the magnetic propulsion systems. And I was there also to collaborate with other companies, and that was one of the things I wanted to do with Bert Rutan, but it never came to fruition. And that was held in San Diego, and as I said, it was a one-year event. It never really got off the ground. It was supposed to be America's answer to the Paris Air Show, but it just, the timing and the tradition and everything else certainly weighed in at the Paris Air Show. I was at some other air shows. There's an air show in, I think it's Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I believe that's the town, but anyway, it turns out that Bert Rutan was there. And he had his Spaceship One and the White Knight Carrier vehicle there on display, and that was after they had won the Ansari X Prize. And so I went over to that. I was living in the Midwest at the time, so I went over, and so I got some pictures of Bert with the spacecraft, etc. And he looked, by the way, he looked just the same. He looked the same as he did in 1986 at the Airspace America Air Show. And of course, having won the X Prize, and there was a lot of news media there, a lot of the fly-ins of that were of his Long Easy series of canards aircraft, rear push-engine airplanes. With the carbon fiber over foam construction technique, and all these people had built these themselves, which leads me to some projects that I am working on in the background. Hopefully, be able to illustrate these someday and put them out into public. But the time frame from 1986 to 1987 was a very rich time, in which I was active, and also it was the time frame. Remember the American Geophysical Union meetings talking about this was the time frame for Halley's Comet, for the Comet Giacobini-Zinner, and the ISWE-3 satellites, and my previous week's talks about the dynamics of a small comet paper, etc. And then the magnetic propulsion system thing. So I was very active, very diverse, and this carried on into the next couple of years. Okay, I want to turn a corner here just a little bit, because given at this point in 1986, 87, and 88, 89 time period, and given the realizations that I had come to about the state of transportation, the ability to move around, and of course, what am I doing? I'm working in the telecommunications industry, fully realizing that telecommunications can be interplanetary, interstellar, etc., and understanding the work that had been done previously, I want to comment on what is known as the Drake equation and a few other comments. And this is regarding life in the universe. Basically, the Drake equation, I've talked about this before, is an equation of it's a probabilistic equation dealing with the percent of are you going to find life. And so what they do is they go through the number of stars, how many planets could be in the Goldilocks zone where there could be life, and how many, what's the time frame to develop an intelligent race or for it to evolve, assuming evolution, of course, into from little cells up to intelligent beings who could then be spacefaring, etc. Would they have the proper conditions and resources to get into space, etc.? And then would they reach out to communicate with other races? And that's where I said, no, the intelligent races would never, ever send out a signal to try and indicate that they were there. The human race and Carl Sagan wanted to do that, but it's really a bad idea. And I used the example of the Mayans and the Incas. Would they have broadcast to Europe saying, hi, we're here, hello, come and see us, and then this message would be received by the Spanish, who would come over and rape and pillage them? No, a very bad idea. But we could potentially pick up inadvertently intelligent signaling and recognize it as intelligent signaling. And so then you get to the point of understanding that there would be 100% probability of life in the universe. If you found a fish in a lake, would you think that's the only fish in the lake? If you found, I talk about this in my book, The Diamond Principle, which of course was published in the 2000s. But if you found a diamond, would you imagine that it's the only diamond in the universe and there would be no more? No, you would immediately know that there are more diamonds like this in the universe, and that there's a process which maybe you wouldn't know about that creates diamonds. But would you assume that there were no other diamonds in the universe? Would you have to travel to the far side of the universe to find diamonds and to say, yeah, there are diamonds over there? We can see all of the gases and the spectrum and everything we see on this planet, we can see all over the universe in the exact same order. So why wouldn't you imagine, without going there, this need to prove it with observation is really an absurdity. And so, and that's one way for science to deny, it's like truth denial, that there could be other life in the universe. The universe would be teeming with life. And just another quick comment, as I'm doing this show in June of 2022, the James Webb Telescope is going online, and there's great expectations of amazing discoveries. But once again, it's great equipment, but bad science coming out of the standard science community. But this is tier two science. Do you think that telescope is not being used by military science that is secret and will never be seen by the public? Of course, it is being used by tier one science, and you will never see the real results. You'll be given this dog and pony show that is NASA and standard science. I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com, and jmccwaterfilters.com. Thank you. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.